So this call is in response. The Secretary has asked Undersecretary Paul DeBar and Director Chris Kvall, who are heading up the COVID-19 response for the Department of Energy, to provide information to the public, specifically to the Secretary of Energy's advisory board. So with that, I'm going to let Dr. Kvall is going to begin with a conversation. Go ahead, Chris.
Thanks, Kurt. Yeah, I'll get started and update you all on the operational posture of the department, and then I think what's probably exciting is how the department is responding, and Undersecretary DeBar will fill you in on that. I'm doing this because the Secretary asked me to coordinate and lead the response for the department for him, and I want to let you know what's going on. First of all, let you know that we have a leadership team that's been stood up across the department to respond to COVID, working extremely well, meeting daily. The Secretary is engaged both with this team as necessary and then through leadership meetings that the Undersecretary for Energy chairs for him twice a week. The department's fully operational, though obviously a lot of what we're doing is being done remotely. Once the president declared the disaster and following White House, OMB, OPM, interagency guidance, we really have transitioned in headquarters at Germantown, the feds in the department, the sites and site offices have transitioned almost completely to telework. There are obviously exceptions. There are folks who man watch centers. There's the Intel operation, which requires a presence in SCIFs, and we're still doing that in person, but we're taking all the appropriate precautions, including protective gear and spacing people out and so forth. Plants, sites have largely transition to remote work, to telework across the entire complex. The science labs certainly mostly on a telework posture, with an important exception, and that's that we're maintaining open operational manned any facilities that need to be available to respond for science and technology related to COVID. So that is still operational. Of course, there are NNSA weapons complex activities that are still being done fully in person, as well as on the EM side, some cleanup activities that still are being done in person. Majority of folks are on telework. As the Undersecretary will tell you, we do have a phenomenal science and technology response. The labs have stood up a sort of national virtual biotechnology consortium. There are projects across all 17 labs, and this group, this science and technology response effort across the labs, is completely tied into the National COVID Task Force. So we have teams engaging with them, and the Undersecretary will talk a little bit about that, plus the more exciting point of developments. I would say less good or less positive is that we have 100,000 people across the complex, and we're tracking about, at this point, 750 of those as concerns. What do I mean by concerns? They may have been in contact with someone who's positive. They may not be feeling well and suspect that they're sick. About 10% of those 750 or 75 are confirmed positive cases. They've been tested. And as you may have read about in the newspaper, we have suffered one fatality. One of our colleagues did pass away as a result of COVID, and they did have an underlying medical condition. So, 750 folks is a lot that we're watching, but out of the 100,000 across the complex, we feel relatively lucky. So I just want to say, sort of summarizing, that the agency quickly responded, was very agile in being able to shift over to a telework posture. I'm not going to go through the significant work that went into that, quickly bulking up IT operations, quickly getting people equipped for telework. Those are details that we could probably share after the fact, but just a remarkable level of effort from the whole team. We're maintaining a sharp focus on our mission essential functions. So as you all know, I think we have a couple of specific responsibilities related to nuclear security and response to nuclear situations. Those teams are active and ready and watching and 100%. We're also 100% on our responsibility for the electrical sector and the grid. Those teams are active and standing watch, and this includes the power marketing administrations and so forth. So all of the things we do for the country, in addition to science and technology, we're still doing in person and with no impact to our capability there. The labs, plants, and sites are safe. They're operating. A lot of it is remote right now. And really what we're doing at this point, in addition to being in touch with our people, making sure they're okay. It's tough when folks are not connected to their work or social networks. We're watching that, not just on the government side, but on the contractor side. But we're now turning our attention to planning for how to start back up again. You know, we don't just turn on the switch and suddenly everyone shows up. There's a lot of work that needs to be done there. There's the potential for some sort of screening that's been talked about on the national scale. No decisions there, but we're taking into account all of these contingencies and thinking about how we start up our operations on the headquarters sides, and each one of the labs, plants, and sites is developing a plan to do that as well. So, very good story on the operational side, and I think obviously we're not having question and answer here. Lots of details, a very positive story, but I think the opportunity now is to let you know what we're doing to help, what we're doing on the science and technology for COVID, and I'll turn things over to the Undersecretary for Science, Mr. DeBar.
Thank you, Director Paul. So, members of CIAB, I'll give an update on different vectors of research and efforts the National Lab Complex is executing on for COVID research, as Director Paul will jump in, periodically as I go through individual areas. As Director Paul mentioned, you know, it's a busy time in the department because with ongoing support for national defense and the strategic program, amongst others, the energy crisis, which is obviously the primary leg of what the department deals with on the applied energy sector. And then the third one is obviously dealing with science to a reasonable degree, the kind of broader efforts that we're dealing with across science are a bit slower due to teleworking, but where there's been a significant increase in efforts in the lab complex to address the COVID crisis. And we have well over 57 projects going on for various different COVID research strings, which I'll give you a summary of. But we have really focused our capabilities, both researchers and user facilities, in a coordinated fashion with other agencies and looking internationally specifically on COVID. So the big buckets, which I'll go through and then give you a few summary points and examples of them, there are what I would call five different buckets of COVID research that we're working on behalf of the country and of the world. The first one is using high-performance computing, including AI and machine learning techniques. Second one is on using imaging resources, our light sources and neutron sources. The third area is around gene sequencing and gene sequencing support. The fourth one is in advanced manufacturing. And the last one is on clinical surveillance and testing support that we're looking to do. So on the first one, I would say the high-performance computing side is probably that and imaging are probably the ones that are the most busy right now. As all of you know, the National Lab Complex is at the top end of supercomputing resources in the world, and the modeling that we've done there across the decades have been focused on what I call the big four areas of science. So that's chemistry, materials, physics, and biology. So given we've supported biology research such as the Human Genome Project and many other items over the years, including drug discovery, it was relatively easy for us to both shift resources on the hardware side and our partnerships around that, as well as research around internal to the lab complex, as well as our partnerships. We were able to pivot to that very, very quickly and started that before this last appropriation. We actually started refocusing our efforts and capabilities that we have towards those areas. I'll hit on there's been a number of the labs that have been looking at small molecule design and potential efficacy that would address either therapies or vaccines. So over a month ago, there was a number of different focal points at Oak Ridge, at Argonne, and at others to try to take a look at those small molecules to go after potential drugs that would have efficacy. And so that was at the pointy end of the spear at the beginning of this, which helps provide various entities, whether at research universities or the private sector, of where to point the potential efforts on therapies or vaccines that would have a higher degree of probability. The second area that I would point on around high-performance computing is something that you may have read regarding the high-performance computing consortium that we've put together with strong leadership of the White House and IBM. So the idea was that there was significant high-performance computing capabilities that could be applied across the country, not only at the DOE National Lab Complex, which is obviously has the biggest machines, but all the other high-performance computers and researchers that know how to use those high-performance computers well beyond the DOE National Lab Complex. So the idea was to roll up the whole country who have those capabilities into one consortium and then solicit the public to submit proposals to use that capability to do research quickly on COVID for very practical topics around the similar points I raised that was done early at the DOE National Complex, just with our own resources. So IBM, OSTP, and us put together this consortium when we launched it a little bit over a week ago now. We have a board. There are over 32 members. So there's a federal footprint that are members, so us, NSF, who obviously funds supercomputing at University of Texas, Illinois, and others around the country, other agencies that have supercomputing capacity besides us and NSF, but then a very long list of private sector led by IBM and their leadership on this. But we now have, as part of the consortium, entities such as Microsoft, Google, Amazon Web Service, Hewlett-Packard Enterprises, Cray, NVIDIA, AMD. It's a long list. It's much longer than what I just said. That gives you an example. So it's very heartening to think that Google and Amazon and the others, and obviously with IBM's leadership, are contributing for free to our resources that they have to help drive COVID research. And so we already have we already received proposals. We quickly review within the matter of, call it, 3 or so days around when those proposals come in. We have a science committee made up by the members to quickly review those proposals. And in under a week, allocate it to a specific resource amongst the list that I gave in that consortium. And we've already received proposals, screened and allocated, and already have 18 in execution right now. So that all happened within about a 10-day period of startup to where we are here today, and active work going on. I'm very heartened by the speed of this and the breadth of this, and the private sector all coming together and volunteering resources from a lot of competitors normally, so to speak, in the tech sector, all coming together to provide resources. Second example that I would like to give is something that was stood up a little bit over a week ago on an interagency point of view within the government, and might go broader, but it's called the COVID Insight Task Force, which was organized by the National Security Council. The idea there was actually conceived of at DOE. And for those of you who may remember something that we stood up a few years ago called the MVP program, using some data that was available from the Veterans Administration to do research on behalf of the VA regarding different things such as a traumatic brain injury and so on that the VA wanted DOE support on. From that idea, that kind of kernel of an idea, we at DOE came up with the idea of why don't we collect resources not only from the VA, where we were getting nightly updates on people across the VA complex, as patients, but in particular people who were getting COVID in the VA system. Why don't we take this and the data enclaves that we have set up already under that system to broaden it to COVID data from NIH, from FDA, from DOD, and additional from VA to really collect all the data potentially in the whole country, Medicare and Medicaid data through CMS, and collect all of that data and evaluate questions that we feel is appropriate, such as what medications using AI, what medications seem to be working, what research, what drivers of the disease, what are the drivers of the disease, and what insights can we get out of that, and then ultimately potentially how to look at phase one or phase two treatment, potential treatments, either therapies or vaccines, collecting all that data from all over the country. And that has been stood up. And the focal point right now is at Oak Ridge National Lab, and we're looking to expand that to the other two as part of the original data enclave system at Livermore and Argonne. We have one interesting paper which we're about to publish, which is consistent with something you should read in the Wall Street Journal today regarding there's a piece of research that Oak Ridge and this data has come out, as well as the Wall Street Journal article you can read today at Yale and some other biotech companies, that possibly the primary driver of the death rate from COVID is not directly from COVID, but it's COVID on basically disrupting the immune system, and that the immune system being shut down or being confused in the lungs is allows other infections to take place. That's just an example, and that paper is in pre-publication and should hopefully come out next week. It's an example of something in which the Oak Ridge team using Summit has looked at this national data and driving on something using supercomputing that seems to be also conclusions coming out elsewhere. And there's many, many other purposes, other vectors of use of the system that we might be able to use. Moving on from computing, one other additional thing around computing is obviously around modeling and epidemiology. I might ask Chris to talk about that a little bit more, as he's been very close to that. Moving on from computing, we obviously have our imaging sources. So the various light sources that we have at LCLS, at SLAC, at Berkeley, Argonne, and Brookhaven, as well as the neutron source at Oak Ridge, allows us to image the virus and how therapies actually go after the virus. This is something we've been doing for a long time at all of the light sources. But for our own research, and for example, at Argonne, there's a standalone beamline that was funded with the private sector to use our resources for biotech discovery for a very long period of time. So this is something that we've already have a great degree of experience with, so it's easy to accelerate that. And so using those to look at potential drug targets in combination potentially with the computing source, but just using the imaging alone has had great value. And once again, as appropriate, Chris can jump in at the end of this on examples. The next area is around advanced manufacturing. Obviously, people have been looking at around ventilators and ventilator components, supply chain, rapid prototyping, reusing face masks, all those sort of aspects have obviously been very topical, and we're also looking at that. And then the last area I would comment to is around clinical surveillance and testing. Once again, Dr. Fall can maybe give some comments as appropriate around this topic. But at a high level, it came across a few weeks ago, in part driven by occupational health of our own workforce and us trying to identify the occupational health of our own workforce. Obviously, our own workforce is exposed to the virus as everyone else, as well as support potentially for the local community. Several of the labs have started thinking about that, and we got together along with the overall COVID task force. Dr. Fall can talk about that as appropriate, about coordinating about whether, A, we could use our capabilities at certain of our national labs who have more of a bio capability to process some testing, both on behalf of our own workforce, not just the national labs, but adjacent DOE employees, contractors, like at EM sites, especially as we ramp back up at some point in time, going back to work and at least getting comfortable from an occupational health point of view, but also our local communities. And we're looking at whether these testing capabilities could support local hospitals. Our biggest footprints, I think, as everyone knows, is in Eastern Washington and the Tri-Cities, where we're the dominant employer, and therefore the community is very much attuned to our footprint as a result of that, as well as in New Mexico, where we're the largest employer in the whole state, and can we support those communities where we have a very large footprint and capabilities in that case, obviously. Sandia and Los Alamos and back on the last topic, PNNL has a big bio presence and is obviously the lab in the Tri-Cities. We're also looking at expanding that also from an occupational point of view at Oak Ridge and maybe others. So that's a bit of a very quick drive-by of the major areas that we're executing on. As Dr. Paul said, from a public health point of view, we've reduced operations across the complex significantly. But what we have actually accelerated in terms of efforts is the sort of things I just described. We're making a material difference in the support for the fight on those capabilities. And there's other things such as the virtual biotech lab and others that maybe I'll ask Dr. Fall to address in this list and then another topics that he'd like to bring up.
Thanks, Undersecretary DeBar. Let me foot stomp just a couple of things that you covered, and then I'll go into a couple of the details that you asked me to expand on. So right out of the gate, when this whole thing started, the Secretary got with us and really implored us to lean forward and use the labs, use our science and technology capability to help where possible, to really pivot our superpower, science at scale, to help with the COVID problem. And what's been really, for me, as someone who's really directly involved with the labs a lot, we know that they're unique and energetic organizations. They like to compete with one another a lot, but in this case, they really have pulled together as one team and opened for the world, for the country, for the world, one front door to quickly get together, collaborate on organized proposals that we've been able to fund and move forward with very quickly, in part because Congress was generous in providing some additional funds in the supplemental to allow our labs to respond, to keep our facilities open and available to our labs, yes, but to industry, to academia, and to the interagency. This is just a great story of what the department, as the Undersecretary said, is doing for the country. He did ask me to expand a little bit on the computational epidemiology work. This is a place where we have deep expertise, in particular, the ability to fuse very different kinds of data together to tell a much richer story. So it's epidemiology combined with very detailed GIS sorts of information and other sources of data to tell one big picture. And this is a capability that a number of the labs have. LANL, Los Alamos in particular, is very good at this. And this stems from their work in weapons, nonproliferation, and so forth. They understand how to track things flowing, track things changing very carefully, and that this expertise, the deep mathematical expertise, computational expertise, has been applied to the epidemiology, and they've been funded for this for a long time from NIH and other sources, so there's a lot of bench strength there. On the testing side, as the Undersecretary said, we've been given, and this took a little bit of a policy, you know, some policy actions, not to get too far in the weeds on the administrivia, but to allow our labs, yes, to test, you know, we have labs with phenomenal biotechnology, molecular biology capability. Yes, they can test for COVID. And so we've built the capacity to test our own people in an occupational health sense, if necessary. And the Secretary has allowed the labs, if there's excess capability available, to help out with the localities in which these labs are situated. That's ongoing, it's developing. But just as important is that, you know, much of the country is dealing with off-the-shelf sort of prepackaged tests that are in limited supply. And one big thrust of our effort is to develop new testing methodologies to make existing testing methodologies more efficient, to get around the roadblocks in reagent supplies by developing, validating, and implementing different methodologies for testing. So those are really great stories. And I'll stop there and let the Undersecretary fill in. And if he has any other questions, I can help expand on.
No, thank you, Dr. Paul. Hopefully members of CEAB got a bit of an overview. I would say that, the ideas coming out of the complex, I think these five buckets, as I just mentioned, HPC, imaging, sequencing, advanced manufacturing, and the surveillance and testing is advancing. I'll give you just another example at Berkeley, obviously a big bio lab experience given their long history there. Has been working on how to manufacture reagents for testing faster with a faster process, and they're working with one entity on that. And separately, they have a biomanufacturing effort. For those you may remember, we just did an X-Lab on biomanufacturing, which has manufacturing for broad potential applications, but one of them is obviously on biotech drugs, and they're working on helping set up a vaccine production line for one of the potential vaccines. And as an example there, this is a vaccine that won't finish phase two trials, but if it reaches a point of having efficacy, you don't want to wait 6 months to start production. So this particular company actually wants to start up a production line while it's doing phase two testing, so that if it turns out it's okay, they actually have some ready to go. And so that's just a couple of other examples. As I said, there's a very long list. I'm very proud of the complex, everything that has been built for decades in terms of the people, and their capabilities on the hardware side, on the user facility side, has all been pivoted very strongly, and they've been generating ideas and executing and making an impact across a large number of areas, and that will continue. They will continue to add things as it goes through. So thank you very much for listening. Hopefully this was a helpful update as requested by the Secretary to you all, and we look forward to talking with you in person through the next video conference, or hopefully in person in the not-so-distant future when the public health issues warrant. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Undersecretary DeBar. Thank you, Dr. Fall. And this will conclude our recording.